Information is available at Shirla at 888-624-4752 for legal help and resources. It is bilingual. More information at chirla.org.
Soy Gregorio Luque y estás escuchando KPFK 90.7 FM en Los Ángeles, 98.7 FM en Santa Bárbara y por el mundo www.kpfk.org. I am Gregorio Luque and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Bárbara, and throughout the world you can contact us at www.kpfk.org.
Well, good afternoon. Good afternoon, KPFK listeners. Welcome to this week's edition of the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host, Maria Hall. Hi, Maria. How you doing?
Hi, Jim. I'm fine, trying to stay cool. How about you?
Yeah, doing the same. I've got some cross breeze here without an air conditioner, but it seems to be working. I know it's a little toasty. Well, it's been a very busy 2 weeks in the courts for the Trump administration. Cases have been decided having to do with, well, what private data DOGE is entitled to collect, for example, whether Trump can withhold billions of dollars in aid, whether Alabama can ban DEI initiatives in its public schools, and the legality of Trump's takeover of the local police in D.C. These cases and more are going to be our topic today of the Lawyers Guild Show. We do this every couple of weeks. We bring you an update on what's been going on in the courts vis-a-vis Trump. Our guest to help us understand this has how things have been going in the courts is, as always, Steve Rohde. Now, Mr. Rohde is a prolific author, several books, scores of articles, book reviews on constitutional law and history. He's the former president of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California. He's a special advisor on free speech and the First Amendment for the Muslim Public Affairs Council. He's also host of the new podcast, Speaking Freely, produced by MS Studios, which is available on Spotify, iHeartRadio, and other streaming platforms. I should also mention that Steve Rohde is also, along with Maria Hall and myself, a host of the national public affairs show Law and Disorder, which now airs, I'm proud to say, in close to 200 radio markets in the nation. Well, Steve Rohde, a warm welcome back to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Well, I guess it's warm down there in L.A. I am so proud and pleased to be with both of you.
All right. Well, let's start right in. We've got a lot to cover. Steve, let's start with your views on a recent federal appeals court decision. Now, it allowed DOGE to access a really good deal of very sensitive data from several federal agencies. What should we know about this case?
Well, what we should know is that it is a sign that the loosening of the rule of law is spreading beyond the U.S. Supreme Court.
Uh-huh.
We're going to discuss several cases today in which often by a 2-to-1 vote, the federal appeals court are turning back injunctions and other rulings. I think they are being schooled by the conservative justices on the U.S. Supreme Court, which is using its shadow docket to do the very same thing. And some of these conservative judges in the intermediary courts are doing that work for the court even beforehand. This is an example. So a federal appeals court Tuesday last week, in a 2-to-1 vote in the Fourth Circuit, is allowing teams of DOGE folks to gain access to potentially sensitive data on millions of Americans, overturning a lower court ruling that had blocked that access in February. So in this 2-to-1 vote, They are allowing access to data stored at the Treasury Department, the Education Department, the Office of Personnel Management, and they're doing it by citing a Supreme Court decision in a related case in June involving Social Security data. But the problem is that that was a shadow docket ruling, and I think we've talked with our listeners before that the shadow docket is a quickie process where without holding oral argument, reading full briefs on the merits, considering the case in chambers, the court, that overwhelming six-member conservative majority is able to uphold what Trump is doing without a full decision on the merits. And now those cases are being cited as precedent as if they were full dress rulings on the merits. Elon Musk, as you know, claimed high level access to government databases. And Judge Julius N. Richardson, a Trump appointee, has written the opinion allowing that invasion of our privacy to go forward. This can include addresses, employer details, related statistics that have been used to identify individuals. Now, he was joined by Judge G. Stephen Agee, who was appointed by George W. Bush. So these are two Republican judges, and I think you're going to see this pattern going forward. Mm-hmm. The dissenting judge, Robert B. King, was a Clinton appointee. He echoed the concerns raised by federal labor unions, which cited the lack of public information about DOJ's operations and its unrestrained approach to seizing sensitive data. Judge King, the dissenter, wrote that a lower court judge had reviewed in detail what was going on and had issued a full dress opinion upholding the injunction. Now, even after Mr. Musk has stepped down in May, DOJ continues to operate, but largely out of public view. And it seems to be pursuing a mission of downsizing federal agencies, which are so important in the lives of American people, and a reduction of government services, which largely won't help anyone. Mm-hmm. So in summary, they are acting in secret while our private data is going to be exposed.
Well, Steve, last week, Trump won another big appellate court victory, which is allowing him to withhold billions of dollars in foreign aid money. Tell us about this case.
Oh, this is equally troubling. I mean, here again is a federal court of appeals, a different panel in a 2-1 decision, which is upholding the Trump administration's continued refusal to spend billions of dollars in foreign aid, finding that aid organizations that had sued to recover the money lacked the legal right to bring the challenge, meaning no standing. These judges will often find procedural obstacles to block the pursuit of justice. These are funds already appropriated by Congress, and a lower court had ordered the government to continue to make the payments Congress had allocated. Congress makes the law, Congress appropriates the funds, and the duty of the president is to take care to faithfully enforce those laws. Yet here again in a 2-1 vote, this was a panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, ruled that under the Impoundment Control Act of 1974, only the Government Accountability Office which serves as Congress's independent watchdog, that only that government agency could sue over this improper impoundment. It's a devastating ruling because nearly $4 billion is allocated to spend on global health activities and more than $6 billion on HIV/AIDS programs was allocated through 2028. The decision on Monday noted that the administration had paid out portions of this money, but other portions remained to be paid. And that is what is so frustrating. Now, the Government Accountability Office, to its credit, has publicly found that the Trump administration illegally impounded funds that were authorized by Congress. And this Government Accountability Office has launched 40 investigations of the Trump administration itself. But under the law, that accountability office not only has the power to issue investigations and to make public pronouncements, but it has the power to sue, to force the release of the impounded funds. But it has not done so yet. The Comptroller General of that agency, Gene Doderow, has said that a legal challenge is the last resort. Well, I think we are visiting the last resort. If the courts are blocking private unions and others who are aggrieved by what Trump is doing, and the courts are saying that only the Government Accountability Office can sue, then it's high time that that office do so. Elise Dunn Gergiou, I'm going to clear my voice, president of the Global Health Council, one of the groups that filed this suit, said her organization would continue to fight to make the funding available. All of this goes back to the fact that on his first day in office, Trump announced a review of the country's foreign aid policies. He froze foreign development assistance and humanitarian aid, while his top aides, including Secretary of State Marco Rubio, began dismantling USAID, the main U.S. aid agency. Trump also placed a moratorium on new funding of projects administered by the State Department. Local judges in several cases have found and have shut down, that the shutting down of these agencies violated the separation of powers. Now, in this 2-1 case, I've already told you that the main judge had done that. He was a Trump appointee, and he voted along with the George W. Bush, H.W. Bush judge. Mm-hmm. But the dissenting opinion by Florence Pan, she was appointed by Joe Biden. She wrote that in addition to the Government Accountability Office, when a party raises constitutional causes of action, that there's a direct violation of the separation of powers, that the unions could equally file suit. She found the 2-1 majority to be erroneous. The majority holds that when the president refuses to spend funds appropriated by Congress based on policy disagreements, that is merely a statutory violation and raises no constitutional alarm bells. Well, Judge Pan was raising constitutional alarm bells. It's a separate violation under the Constitution. I'm very concerned, though, that when you get a 2-1 vote like this, all the Supreme Court has to do is deny cert. Mm-hmm. And until that case is heard on the merits months and months from now, all of those nefarious cutbacks on foreign aid will continue.
Yeah. Goodness, goodness, goodness. Well, Steve, moving right along, a federal judge in Alabama refused to block Alabama from banning DEI initiatives in Alabama's public schools. Remind our audience what DEI initiatives are and talk to us about the judge's ruling in this case. Again, a victory for Trump, it would seem.
This is a very dangerous case. And I don't think the banning of DEI initiatives is getting the attention it deserves across the country. We are literally living in a period where affirmative action, combating racial prejudice and racial discrimination, and frankly, discrimination of all forms against women, LGBTQ persons, people of color, and other minorities, that whole bulwark of American society, which has been developed and strengthened for decades, is now being demonized simply by labeling it woke or by demeaning it by burying the words diversity, equity, and inclusion in the nomenclature of DEI. This is spreading throughout the federal government. You are hearing in the last few days that Trump is upset that the Smithsonian museums have the audacity to discuss slavery and dark periods in American life. This was a marginal right-wing effort years ago. It is now has the force of law, both in the federal government and in these state governments. So in this case, Alabama passed a law banning diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives in public schools. On October 8, last week, a federal judge, David Proctor, a Bush appointee, refused to block the Alabama law. He wrote that the University of Alabama students and professors who had filed the lawsuit challenging the law did not meet the legal requirements for a preliminary injunction, which he called an extraordinary and drastic remedy. Well, it wasn't the remedy that's extraordinary and drastic. It's the banishment of diversity, equity, and inclusion from our public schools. Now, the Alabama measure took effect last October, 2024, during the run-up to the election. It was part of a wave of proposals from Republican lawmakers across the country taking aim at DEI programs on college campuses. The Alabama law in this case prohibits public schools from funding or sponsoring what it calls DEI programs. It prohibits schools from requiring students assent to 8, quote, divisive concepts. What it's done here is it teased out different principles and really distortions of DEI. So you can no longer fault, blame, or have bias assigned to a race or sex, or that any person should acknowledge a sense of guilt, complicity, or a need to apologize because of their race, sex, or national origin. Now, this is what the right wing has done recently. What they're alluding to is the degree to which white supremacy holds sway in early American history and in many respects to this very day. They're acting like they are passing laws for equal opportunity. And what they're really doing is undermining the teaching of American history by labeling it as causing guilt, complicity, or a need to apologize. Frankly, I think the United States has a lot to apologize for all of this, and that's why the reparations movement is so important. Six professors and students at the University of Alabama filed a lawsuit claiming that this violated the First Amendment by placing a viewpoint-based restrictions. It's only one side of the discussion of white supremacy and slavery that's being censored. They produced evidence that professors have altered how they are teaching their classes, that there's reduced coverage of the Black Power movement, of Black Lives Matter, of white nationalist movements in the wake of the law. And another five students had complaints suggesting that interdisciplinary honors programs that had been administered were being cut back. The Black students' unions are being shuttered. LGBTQ student resource centers are being shuttered. And in the face of all of those attacks on academic freedom and student freedom, this judge refused to enjoin that statute. He said teachers can keep discussing these issues as long as they do it in an objective manner without indoctrination. And how is a college teacher going to tell when their class discussions, class debates, indoctrinate rather than discuss a particular topic? Mm-hmm. Finally, Will Creeley, a legal director at the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, FIRE, criticized the decision as dangerous and as at odds with decades of Supreme Court precedent on academic freedom. We can only hope that the case will be briefed and on appeal, and that at least two judges or en banc review will see the light and stop this nefarious intrusion on academic freedom and the teaching of American history.
Mm-hmm. Well, Steve, let's now go to Washington, D.C. D.C. officials have now sued the Trump administration over its takeover of the D.C. police force. Talk to us about this lawsuit, including the legal argument of D.C. officials who've brought the lawsuit.
Yes. You know, when people fight back, and in this case, large institutions, the entire District of Columbia, it is heartening. I mean, these cases are being brought. These issues are being raised. Here, the District of Columbia has filed suit because Donald Trump announced an emergency, placing the city of D.C. Police Department under federal control. You and your listeners know full well that Trump is citing emergencies at every turn whenever he wants to try to invoke special expanded powers. In this case, there is a D.C. Home Rule Act, which does grant the U.S. president authority over local police during, quote, special conditions of an emergency nature. Now, what Trump does is he distorts the facts. He lies about the degree to which there is any emergency regarding fighting crime in D.C., whereby many measures crime statistics are down. But reacting in her complicit way, Attorney General Pam Bondi issued a directive ordering the mayor of D.C. and the D.C. police to implement a broad range of actions, and they've appointed the Drug Enforcement Administrator head, Terry Cole, as emergency police commissioner. That's been challenged. They're vesting and purporting to vest broad powers and rescinding D.C. police policies, including sanctuary city protections. They are also rummaging around the records of the police department to try to prove that crime statistics have been falsified by city employees. The D.C. Attorney General, Brian Schwab, has argued that Trump exceeded his legal authority and violated constitutional principles of local self-government. It's a great concern because the administration's unlawful actions have been called an affront to dignity and the autonomy of the 700 Americans who call D.C. home. And all it does for me is bring attention again to the great injustice that 700,000 Americans living in D.C. do not have statehood and do not have the full enjoyment and privileges that all the rest of us have. We're very hopeful this lawsuit will lead to immediate injunctive relief, trimming back whatever Trump purports to do.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Well, Steve, also a federal appeals court, going back again to the level of the federal appellate court, has allowed the dismantling of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. He's allowed it to continue, is what he's done. What's the significance of this appellate court ruling, and what's it likely to mean for the average American?
This is just an example of Trump and his minions trashing through federal government programs that were designed and were implemented to help average Americans. This is, after all, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which has been going to bat for American consumers for years to try to protect us from all kinds of consumer fraud and violations of the law by businesses and corporations. As a result, back on March 28, Judge Amy Berman Jackson, a U.S. District judge, granted a preliminary injunction requiring the reinstatement with back pay of the CFPB employees that had been fired at Trump's instigation. But unfortunately, on August 15, barely a few days ago, again by a 2-1 vote, the D.C. Circuit dissolved that preliminary injunction. Now, it threw a bone to the petitioners. It delayed the mandate, which is the official order itself, until September 29. To allow the petitioners to seek rehearing or what is called en banc consideration. There are 11 judges on the D.C. Circuit. It takes six of them to overrule what this one panel did. And there are seven Obama and Biden judges on the D.C. Circuit. So there is some hope that they will support the previous injunction. Now, this case was brought by the National Treasury Employees Union, the CFPB Employees Association, the Virginia Poverty Law Center, and the NAACP. But here again, and I think the pattern is crystal clear today, the order was given by Judge Gregory Katsas, a Trump appointee, joined in by Judge Naomi Rao, another Trump appointee. A strong dissent was issued by Cornelia T.L. Pillard, an Obama appointee. The dissent said the government cannot shut down the CFPB. And in this clever trickery that the Trump administration is engaging in, and that the two Trump judges accepted, they've all said, oh, we're not shutting down the CFPB. We're merely reorganizing it. Mm-hmm. They're beginning and have continued for over 6 months to play those kinds of word games. They play it with the American people and they play it with the courts. The dissenting judge said that she accepted the evidence that had been adduced before the district judge that Trump was, in fact, dismantling the CFPB. The evidence showed the firing of 1,400 employees and other steps. All of this was similar to how Trump is dismantling the Department of Education, but claiming that he is simply reorganizing it. Well, you can reorganize something out of existence. Yes, and that's exactly what's happening in this case. It is tragic that two federal appellate courts are showing more fidelity to Trump than they are showing to the laws passed by Congress and by the Constitution itself.
Well, all right. We are at the halfway mark on our show today, so it's time to stop and take a very brief station identification. You stay tuned. We'll be right back with you.
KPFK invites you to tune into The Global Village, weekdays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., bringing you a global mix of hosts seeking the universal soul and making musical connections between our geographical and musical cultures. That's The Global Village, KPFK's flagship music program, with new and familiar voices, Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., right here on 90.7 FM and online at kpfk.org.
And indeed, we are right back with you. That was a short ID break, so we're right back with you. You're still listening to the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm still Jim Lafferty, along with Maria Hall, the co-host of the show. And happily still with us is our guest, which we have on every couple of weeks to bring you up to date on some of the court rulings that have been taking place, important court rulings having to do with the Trump administration and the many shenanigans of that administration. He is, of course, Steve Brody, constitutional author and scholar. And Steve, before we move on to the next question, all these dismantlings that are going on, it's hard unless you're, and for example, in this case, where you're talking about consumer financial protection, that agency performs a real service. It's not simply a bunch of people sitting around studying something in Washington, D.C., am I right? And a lot of our listeners perhaps have had reason to benefit from the work of that agency to the extent that it is diminished in terms of the number of employees in it, effectively shutting down all that it can do. It has an actual effect on the pocketbooks and on the rights of the average American citizen who may have come foul of some financial dealings.
You're absolutely right. And let's break it down. Who are the beneficiaries of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau? They are average Americans.
Yeah.
That bureau has brought investigations and lawsuits about consumer fraud, about increased charges by credit card companies. But who, by and large, is on the other side of those debates? Big business. What the Republican Party has done for years is attack this agency. And now by installing Trump and with the favoritism of Republican judges, they are achieving through executive order and court rulings what they could not achieve through the democratic process in Congress and in debating and passing laws and statutes. It is clearly doing the bidding of the Republican agenda. Corporations are getting a windfall to be relieved from oversight by such an important agency such as the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Oh, dear.
Well, Steve, another important institution are colleges and universities, and the Trump administration has gone after the UC system, the University of California system, as he has major colleges and universities around the country. But UCLA scored a legal win over Trump that might prompt a different strategy in similar cases. Tell us about that strategy that UCLA recently employed.
Well, I will immediately say it was UCLA faculty that won this success. And for the rest of our show, I hope we're going to have a few hopeful signs to not leave your audience in despair. So a group of faculty sued the Trump administration, and they scored a victory for UCLA's LA branch. It's really the first win in the university context. U.S. District Judge Rita Lynn granted an order. She ordered the Trump administration to restore a portion of the more than $550 million the president had paused after the federal government found the University of California was in violation of federal civil rights laws over alleged anti-Semitism on campus. Putting that aside, we've discussed at length how combating anti-Semitism has been weaponized by this administration. But in this case, researchers who needed this money for the research projects that literally are going on every day fought back. The lawsuit challenged the institution, and meaning the administration. Judge Lynn issued a preliminary injunction to have the funding restored. Now, here again, in terms of word games and word tricks, she had previously enjoined the government in the sense of ordering them to reinstate these funds. And the federal government had the audacity to argue that these particular grants didn't fall within her preliminary injunction because they were suspended, not terminated. Well, she would have none of that. This is the trickery that the administration lawyers are using in the area of deportations and elsewhere. So she made it perfectly clear, quote, "For avoidance of doubt, the court also clarifies that grant termination, as the term is used in the preliminary injunction, encompasses circumstances where grant funding is cut off on a long-term or indefinite basis, like the suspensions carried out by the National Science Foundation on July 30. So this is important. This is the first successful case of a university clawing back funding after the Trump administration had paused it. The implications could be tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars. Claudia Polsky, the director of the Environmental Law Clinic at the University of California, and one of the plaintiffs in the case, applauded the case. She said it will have both practical impacts, because those dollars are so crucial to the research that's going on, and it will have political impact by pushing back and demonstrating to other universities that you can push back. Unfortunately, Columbia and Brown University have struck deals with the administration to pay hefty sums and change their hiring and admissions policies. Harvard is the only institution that has sued the Trump administration after the White House cut off $2.5 billion in federal money. A hearing was held in that case at the end of July, and we're waiting on a judge to issue a ruling in the Harvard case. Universities are fighting back, but faculty who do the hard research and teaching every day, they are fighting back too.
And I assume, though, that the UC faculty that has this partial victory so far is going to face an appeal. Don't we assume that?
Oh, there's no question. Now, that will go to the Ninth Circuit. Mm-hmm. The Ninth Circuit has largely been called a liberal circuit, although there have been a few bad rulings in recent days in the area of immigration law. But hope springs eternal, and strong rulings by the appellate court could help bolster what these brave faculty members are doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, another university case, and kind of a David and Goliath case, if you will, when you think about it. I'm thinking of the case of Stanford University, where its student newspaper is suing Trump. I love it. Student newspaper is suing the president of the United States. They filed a lawsuit that accuses officials in the administration of weaponizing immigration law for the purpose of silencing political dissent and thereby violating the Constitution. Talk to us about the facts of this case and what do you think its likely chances of success might be?
I was so thrilled to see this case filed. Here is a student newspaper, again, stepping in where the universities have, except for Harvard, have not sued, and some have capitulated. Stanford Daily, a prominent student newspaper, plus two anonymous non-citizen students joined in this federal lawsuit, accusing the Trump administration of silencing political dissent in violation of the First and Fifth Amendments. The suit was filed on August 6 in a federal court in San Jose. It challenged Secretary of State Marco Rubio's sweeping claim that he can revoke visas at any time in his discretion and deport non-citizens if he determines their speech, their actual speech and writing, compromises, quote, a compelling U.S. foreign policy interest. This all derived from a January executive order by Trump that purported to expand the administration's authority to restrict entry and revoke visas of perceived threats to national security or foreign policy. Fortunately, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, FIRE, is representing the Stanford Daily and those two non-citizens. The attorney representing the plaintiff said in the United States of America, no one should fear a midnight knock on the door for voicing the wrong opinion. Free speech isn't a privilege the government hands out. Under our Constitution, it is the inalienable right of every man, woman, and child. And I would add to that, or define that as persons. Many people, including Trump and much in his administration, they think that the First Amendment, and indeed the whole Bill of Rights, including due process, only protects citizens of the United States. You will search the Bill of Rights. You will see terms like people, persons. It is every person in the United States that's protected by those laws. It's also pointed out by Greta Reich, the editor-in-chief of the Stanford Daily. She said, there's real fear on campus and it reaches into the newsroom. I've had reporters turn down assignments, request the removal of some of their articles, and even quit the paper because they fear deportation or being associated with speaking on political topics, even in a journalistic capacity. You know, it really reminds me, because the government is using the Canary Mission website, which puts up profiles of people it labels as anti-Israel and therefore anti-U.S. You and listeners may remember in the McCarthy era, there was the Red Channels list. Private organizations would list targets to be blacklisted. That's exactly what's going on again today, and fortunately, this lawsuit is fighting back. None of this is imaginary. We all know that Muhammad Khalil at Columbia was arrested and held in a detention center in Louisiana for over 100 days. We know that Tufts PhD student Rumase Uzturk, a Turkish citizen on a student visa, was detained, grabbed in the dark of night because she co-authored an op-ed critical of the university's investment ties with Israel. Her visa was revoked, and she's fighting that case while Marco Rubio calls her a Hamas supporter. This is what this lawsuit is about. The lawsuit says this pall of fear is incompatible with American liberty. Our First Amendment stands as a bulwark against the government infringing the inalienable human rights to speak and think for yourself. I'm so proud indeed of the student newspaper, the anonymous non-citizen students, and the FIRE organization for bringing that case. I hope they have an early success.
Indeed, indeed. All right.
Well, Steve, there's a bill that's been introduced in Congress called the Neighbors Not Enemies Act, which could undermine Trump's use of the 1798 Alien Enemies Act, which we've discussed on the show previously. Who's introduced this legislation? What would it do if passed? And what is the likelihood of it passing in the Republican-controlled Congress?
Well, you know, I wanted to speak about this today because folks have told me after some of our interviews that I've just depressed the hell out of them, and I've made them even more hopeless. Well, we all know that's not my purpose. My purpose is the belief that well-educated, knowledgeable activists are the ones that are going to resist, mobilize, and organize to take back our democracy. And I'm glad when in the halls of Congress you begin to see some strength and spine being exhibited. Now, we do know that on March 15, Trump invoked the Alien Enemies Act of 1798 to try to deport non-citizens without due process. That's a law that was shameful because it was written and signed by John Adams in the wake of the First Amendment itself. It spoke of deporting foreigners in time of war and insurrection, or not insurrection, but aggression, none of which exists today. Yet Trump is trying to use that law. Now, without giving individuals notice, immigration judges, in a clear violation of their due process rights, have been processing these cases. That's why the Neighbors Not Enemies Act, and for listeners, that's S-193, was introduced by Senator Mazi Hirono, a Democrat of Hawaii, and it is being co-sponsored by our very own Alex Padilla, California's U.S. Senator. It would repeal the Alien Enemies Act. It's awaiting consideration in the Senate Judiciary Committee, where Padilla, among others, is a member. Let's remember in this context again that the U.S. Constitution grants every person in the United States, regardless of their immigration status, the right to due process. Non-citizens, like citizens, must be informed of the charges against them and be given an opportunity to be heard in immigration court and to retain counsel before being removed to another country. I think this law is important for many reasons. It's an example that we're going to have to be proactive. We can't just be fighting the big, ugly bill or the next initiative that the Republicans enact in furtherance of the Trump administration. We have to demonstrate to the American people what democracy looks like. And the Neighbors Not Enemies Act, S-193, does that. And I encourage listeners in California and elsewhere to call their senators and to fully support S-193.
Absolutely, absolutely. Steve, there one of the things that is, and there's so many, my list is long, but the separation of church and state is always something that's been very close to my heart. And when Texas announced some time ago and ordered its public schools to display, you know, the Ten Commandments, it irritated an awful lot of people, myself included. But there's a piece of breaking news that I'd like to ask you about. Apparently, a judge now in Texas has just halted that Texas law mandating the Ten Commandments be displayed in public schools in Texas. Your thoughts on this?
This is a banner day for separation of church and state. Literally this morning, a federal judge in Texas temporarily halted a Texas law which would have mandated the Ten Commandments to be visibly displayed in every public school classroom by September 1st. Looking at this more broadly, again, this was a pillar of the right, hard right Republican agenda to intrude religion into our public schools. They are feeling bolstered by what they are seeing Trump doing and the Supreme Court doing and some of the lower courts are doing. And they have simply put on fast forward statutes like this in many different states. This law was passed by the Texas Republican-controlled legislature, and we certainly all know that the Texas legislature is Republican-controlled, as we're seeing in the redistricting controversy. But what they did is they mirrored laws that have already been declared plainly unconstitutional, including most recently in June by a panel of judges looking at a Louisiana law. And that case was from the conservative U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans. And another federal judge blocked a nearly identical measure in Arkansas this month. Well, in Texas, 16 families from different faith backgrounds brought the legal challenge. They argued the law would pressure students to adopt a state-favored religious scripture, and that it amounted to a clear violation of separation of church and state. In fact, the version of the Ten Commandments was specifically the King James Bible version, and there are even differences among Christians on versions of the Ten Commandments. Now, you do get strange bedfellows in terms of arguments. Some of the parents in this case complained because the Ten Commandments is inappropriate for young children. They said that lines like, "Thou shalt not commit adultery," or "Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife," that was offensive to them being posted in the classroom. And Judge Fred Beery of the Western District of Texas, who halted the public display, he had a little fun with it. In his decision, he said, "Teenage boys, being the curious, hormonally driven creatures they are, might ask their teacher, 'Mrs. Walker, I know about lying and I love my parents, but how do I do adultery?'" Well, he had some fun with that, but fortunately, his fun was in the midst of a very important ruling that enjoined this case. This Texas law is so outlandish because it required the display in a conspicuous location in each classroom with a typeface visible from anywhere in the classroom. The poster had to be 16 inches wide and 20 inches tall and have nothing else on it but the text of the Ten Commandments. School districts could accept donation for the posters, or they could accept and use district funds to buy them. Well, Rabbi Mara Nathan one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit. She lives in San Antonio. She said, "The public school is a secular space. It feels like our freedoms are being encroached upon when students are going to walk into a classroom and immediately be presented with religious doctrine." Now, you know, Texas needs to study the law. The Supreme Court struck down a similar Kentucky law in 1980 on First Amendment grounds. But supporters of the Texas law are so bolstered by what's going on. There have been recent cases. You may remember that in 2022, the Supreme Court ruled that a high school football coach had a constitutional right to pray on the field after a team's game. Well, they're trying to take that one example and expand it into publishing and posting the Ten Commandments. I'm pleased with this ruling, and I'm hopeful it will be upheld based on long-standing court precedent.
Well, Steve, we are running out of time, but I wanted to get in one last question. If we could touch on voting rights. Trump wants to force states to get rid of mail-in ballots and other aspects of voting that he doesn't favor. Does he have the constitutional authority to do this?
Can I make this one simple? No. Congress, the Constitution actually initially places responsibility for the times, places, and manner of elections in the several states, with Congress having certain supervisorial authority over federal elections. Trump is falsely complaining that vote by mail is a scam. He falsely claims that voting machines are highly inaccurate and more expensive. That's an utter falsehood. Research shows that hand counting is less accurate and more expensive. He claims to be using the best lawyers to devise this threatened executive order. But I want to be sure listeners today hear where Trump got this idea. When he was in Alaska with Putin, and he openly admitted this to Sean Hannity, Trump admitted it to Sean Hannity, quote, "Putin said something, one of the most interesting things he said, your elections are rigged because you have mail-in voting," unquote. Quote, Donald Trump to Sean Hannity, quote, "Vladimir Putin, smart guy, said you can't have an honest election with mail-in voting." Ladies and gentlemen and others, can you understand and appreciate, and I'm saying that respectfully, the depth to which Donald Trump has fallen, that he's getting his legal and policy advice from Vladimir Putin? Let's just be sure that we know what's going on. And when he met with the Ukrainian leader, he said he learned that elections have been suspended in Ukraine during a war. And Donald Trump said, "So let me just say, 3.5 years from now, so you mean if we happen to be in a war with somebody, no more elections? Oh, that's good." That's Donald Trump caught an open mic.
Yes, indeed.
That's what we're facing. We've got to know what we're facing so we can organize. Lawsuits are necessary but not sufficient. What is necessary are programs like the Lawyers Guild show.
Well, and guests like Stephen Rohde, I can tell you that. We so thank you for doing this. You put a lot of effort into, I know, when you join us every couple of weeks, you don't just grab a headline and recite the headline. And we appreciate that. I know the listeners have expressed the fact that they appreciate that as well. So thank you again for joining us again this week with your very thoughtful analysis of these cases. We'll continue to do this on the Lawyers Guild show a couple of times a month. as long as the need exists, and I'm afraid it's going to exist for a while. We had some victories today, but a good many defeats, and that's all very troubling in terms of looking at the way some of the cases are going. So we'll keep on top of it here. And as always, urge our listeners to take every opportunity they can to voice their protest to these, whether it's outrageous decisions or outrageous pieces of legislation. But until next week at the same time, we thank you for listening today to the Lawyers Guild Show. We promise you we'll be back